Court will now call Appeal 22-2454, Isabella Rana versus the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin. We'll begin with argument from the appellant, Ms. Brodsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. It may please the court. I'm Alexandra Brodsky for appellant Isabella Rana. Title IX's text is on Isabel's side. Consider the sole element on which the district court ruled against her, the required educational deprivation. The university argues this case shouldn't go to a jury because every Title IX plaintiff needs to show her grades got worse and Isabel's didn't. But the plain language of the statute forecloses that reading. It forbids students from being excluded from participation in or denied the benefits of the school. Because a jury could find Isabel experienced those kinds of educational injuries, even if her grades remain strong, the university is not entitled to summary judgment on this element.
Ms. Brodsky, may I start you off, please? Could you please discuss how one severe instance of sexual assault off campus could lead to a university's liability under Title IX, even if no further acts of harassment take place after the university learns of the assault?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I promise I'll answer the question directly. What I'll say first is that the university has forfeited the argument about the off-campus location of the harassment. And I don't think that this court needs to reach the question.
Let's assume they didn't for the purpose of the question.
Sure. I also don't think that this court needs to reach the question about a single incident because this isn't a single incident case. But to address these three issues and to get in reverse order. We know from Davis, Gebser, Jackson that deliberate indifference to sexual harassment is itself intentional sex discrimination. So if a school's deliberate indifference to sexual harassment causes a student to be excluded from participation in or denied the benefits of the school, that's a Title IX claim. And we know from cases like this one, like Waymer, like Fairfax, like Farmer, that a student can experience one of those kinds of educational deprivations without additional harassment. Because a school's deliberate indifference, and I think Waymer puts this particularly eloquently, can put a student in the terrible bind of having to choose between their education and their safety. And in that circumstance, many victims will choose to sacrifice their education in order to remain safe. And the university would have the school instead treat Title IX like a sexual harassment tort, in which the only, quote, relevant harm is additional sexual harassment. But the plain language of the statute forecloses that reading as well. On the question of whether a single assault can be enough, I think that the First Circuit in Fitzgerald, the Fourth Circuit in Fairfax are correct that a single assault combined especially with the exacerbating effects of the school's deliberate indifference can have the requisite effect. But again, and I think that Isabel's case shows as much. You can see how the rape pervaded her whole experience at the school. But this isn't a single incident case. There were multiple rapes on the night in question. Seekers also recruited his roommate to take photographs of Isabel and the other victim in a vulnerable state between the rapes. There's then a post-assault hostile environment because of Seekers' presence, which he then exacerbates by his first available opportunity, the first time he sees her after the rapes, making a beeline for her such that her lawyer has to step in front of Isabel in order to prevent physical contact. And I know that
if the university had responded to this incident in the first instance by suspending Cephas for 5 months and imposing a no contact order, would that have been deliberately indifferent? And what was the most analogous case that you can point us to that would reach the result that for which you're arguing over that question?
So I think that the answer is that would be a more reasonable response. So if we're looking at a spectrum of clearly unreasonable to clearly reasonable, it moves us toward reasonable. I do think it would turn on what the school, whether they provided additional safety measures on top of the no contact order once CFIS violated it. Because I think that a no contact order might be a reasonable place for a school to start. And this case is not a referendum on whether no contact orders are.
Did you already concede this point? Did you already concede this point that the university was not deliberately indifferent in its original response?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. So I agree that if the school had not reinstated CFIS, that there would not be a deliberate indifference case here. I took your question to be if instead of expelling CFIS, the school had suspended him, could that have been enough? And Isabel's position is not and could not be that the school had to expel CFIS. I think that Davis is clear about that. But there are fact and case-specific questions about whether the no-contact order here was enough. And just to run through some of those. There's the fact that CFIS had violated it. It's the fact that he had violated it as first available opportunity.
Can I just ask about that? I mean, he was required to be at that disciplinary, right? So that was sort of, he had to be there.
That's right. And I think if the issue was just that they were in a room together, which could in other circumstances be a violation of a no contact order, I don't think that that would do anything for Isabel here. But there's a dispute of fact about what happened to that room. And Isabel's testimony and her witness's testimony is that CFIS makes a beeline for her, is about to make physical contact with her.
Didn't that all occur before he was expelled? Wasn't that just part of the stuff that you just conceded that was not deliberate indifference? I thought that hearing occurred before he was reinstated.
It did, Your Honor. If CFIS had remained expelled, then his presence wouldn't have posed a continued threat to her that required more than a no-contact order. Just to run through a couple other factors that I think a jury could look at to think that more than a no-contact order was required here. There's the fact that CFIS had an extensive disciplinary history from before these rapes, which included previous allegations of sexual harassment.
The no-contact order, just so we're clear, was entirely effective. They never even saw each other after he was reinstated, right?
I think a jury could disagree, Your Honor. A jury could agree.
Are there facts in the record that suggest that they saw each other after the no-contact order was reinstated? After he was reinstated, how could a jury conclude that based on no facts?
Your Honor, I agree that a jury could easily find that there was not, that they didn't see each other again other than this time before the hearing.
But they find that they did?
Your Honor, I don't know that they could, but I think the distinction is that that doesn't mean that the no-contact order was effective. So we have the one instance when they see each other when it's not effective. And then a jury could find, as the panel majority held, that a jury could find that the reason they didn't see each other was that Isabel was hiding in her dorm room, that she took steps to protect herself, and that's why she didn't see him again.
Do you realize the breadth of your argument that Isabel was subjected to hostile environment after the assaults due to CFIS's continued presence on campus? The breadth of that argument is that the University of Wisconsin, in order to avoid liability under your theory, had to expel him. Including the fourth grader has to be kicked out of class for bullying, has to be kicked out of school, in the high school or in the middle school, and on and on and on.
I disagree, Your Honor, because Davis is clear that schools don't actually have to fully ameliorate a hostile environment or end the
harassment. We have a situation where you acknowledge there are no facts that they even saw each other after he was reinstated. Not zero. They didn't even see each other. And yet your argument is that just his presence on the University of Wisconsin campus, one of the biggest campuses in America, created a hostile work environment for him. Imagine a fourth grader.
So, Your Honor, I think
maybe he'd be banished from the town under your theory.
I disagree, Your Honor, again, because the school doesn't actually have to fully ameliorate the hostile environment. The question is just whether their response to that hostile environment is clearly unreasonable.
What more should it be?
Maybe it'd be helpful to flip to the other side of the question. We have outlined, for at least what we've heard this morning, the deliberate indifference as far as what happened before. And so I guess the other side of that question would be, what is the best argument for Alana for why the university's response was clearly unreasonable? What would be the response to that question?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think a jury wouldn't have to, but could look at this record as a whole and determine that the university believed that CFIS had raped her, had arranged for photographs of her, had created a hostile environment for her. Its own finding based on its knowledge.
I want to start, though, at the timing of the readmission.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we start there,
so the
that
school,
would be helpful.
Absolutely. So the school, with that knowledge, nonetheless decides to reverse its finding, reverse its remedy, because of these external pressures from donors and fans, and without putting in place additional measures, fully knowing based on its previous findings exactly the effect that Cephas's readmission would have on Isabel.
Are you suggesting that they should not have considered at all the jury acquittal? I thought Judge Pryor tried to move you ahead, and then you went back and said, well, based on those facts, based on the knowledge that Cephas had raped her, but I think a jury had concluded that he hadn't. And I mean, the university is going to get sued here by someone, right? Cephas or by Iran. So what could the university have done to answer Judge Pryor's question based on what they knew at the time he was reinstated?
Sure. So I think there are two questions in there, which is what is the relevance of the school's previous findings to what it does with the reinstatement? And then what is the relevance of the jury acquittal? So to take each of those, our theory here is that the school, in fact, not that the school was legally compelled to believe Isabel, but that it did believe Isabel and nonetheless readmit Cephas without providing the additional safety measures that would allow her to have equal access to education. And that's where the consideration of the school's reasoning comes in. It's not that the school is liable because it got the answer wrong. It's that one piece of the puzzle is that after this readmission, because of the external pressure, it offers a post hoc justification for its actions to try to obscure its true motives. And
are you suggesting that the rationale to readmit had to be pretextual because of how the university had responded initially?
I don't think it had to be pretextual. It's possible that new evidence would have come out at trial that genuinely convinced the school and it would have then properly readmitted Cephas. But I do think that there is evidence that the school did not in fact change its mind. That instead—
Does the rationale really matter if she's still protected after these rape?
Yes, Your Honor, for two reasons. One is that we don't think that she was adequately protected afterwards.
Assume she was. Assume they had given her all of the protection she had asked for. They gave her a private security guard and everything else she wanted. Would the rationale matter then as to why they raped her?
I think the rationale would be relevant, but it might not be enough to go over the line to a clearly unreasonable response. I think it is more unreasonable to expel a student based on university findings and then readmit him in determining that expulsion is the appropriate remedy and then readmit him because the guy whose name is on the football facilities wants him to, than it would be to determine in the first instance that a 2 month, 5 month suspension might be enough. But the school then doesn't provide her sufficient safety measures after the fact. And just to go to your question about pretext, Your Honor, I think that there are a number of facts that a jury could look at to determine that the post hoc justification here was pretextual. Part of it is that the university can't articulate it until a post deposition declaration. There's the fact that the process itself was rushed and one-sided in stark contrast to all of the university's previous proceedings in this investigation. There's the fact that justification just doesn't really hold water, or at least a jury finds that. And you put all of these pieces together, along with the fact that the VP in charge of the public relations response regarding Cephas is directly consulting on this decision to the exclusion of the Title IX coordinator. You put all of that together and a jury could say, I don't think you were really trying to find the truth. I think if you were trying to find the truth, you would have brought in Isabel and her lawyer rather than doing this one side quick reversal. And I'd like to just say something about the university's reliance on its own regulations that it says didn't require it to include Isabel. So I guess 2 points the matter of law. Obviously, if there was a conflict between federal law and a school regulation, federal law would trump. I also don't think it would be a defense for a school to say, well, sure, we acted clearly unreasonably, but only because our policy required us to.
But you've argued it was bad faith to do that. And how can you say it's bad faith if you're relying on state court or state policy?
So these were regulations that were not a sexual harassment policy. They were instead generally applicable procedures for non-academic student discipline, a lot of which doesn't involve a student counterparty. So these would apply if, let's say, a student damaged university property. That's a dispute between the student and the university. And you see that reflected in how these regulations are designed, that by the university's own telling, and this is in document 165, these were really focused on the due process rights for the accused. And also according to the university, they gave the chancellor unfettered discretion in how to consider a petition for readmission. And so what that means is that any Title IX responsibilities of the school were not built into those regulations. They were instead going to have to layer on. And just to give you one other example from those state regulations, they also allow for the school and the respondent student to delay a hearing for as long as they agree to. That could make sense if we're talking about destruction of university property, where there's no one else to complain about that delay. But if here the university had gone to CFIS and say, hey, let's delay the hearing by 3 years so that you can be recruited by the NFL, Isabel would have a lot to complain about then. I think that that could be clearly unreasonable. And the fact that it was technically permitted by the regulations, in the same way that her exclusion was technically from the petition was technically permitted, wouldn't be a defense there.
Ms. Bronski, can I go rewinding a bit and going back to Judge Kirsch's concern with regard to the petitioner kind of concerns after the no contact order was in place and CFIS was readmitted? I think Judge Kirsch raises a good question with regard to what a limiting principle might be. So here, let's say hypothetically, a person who was victim of sexual assault goes through this process, gets a new contact order, and the alleged attacker leaves campus. Okay. But the complainant still feels very threatened because the possibility that he might come back and doesn't go to class, right? So just subjective fear. I think one of the questions is that enough just to establish deliberate indifference? That is, the fact that the complainant has subjective fear, okay? And if it's not, then what is a limiting principle? Because I think the facts would be different and you'd have a stronger argument if, say, after CFIS is admitted, they again are enrolled in the same class, okay? And then Arana comes and says, you know what, we're in the same class. I feel really threatened. He sits right next to me, or he comes my lab partner, and can you do something? And the university's like, no, you know, there's no incidents of harassment, so you're good. I think we would say that those facts are different from a simple case, from another case, from the extreme that I gave you, where the alleged attacker leaves campus and the student just stays in her room because she's subjectively fearful. So what is that rule that you want us to articulate distinguishing those two types of people?
Sure, so I think one limiting principle is I do think that the experience of the hostile environment has to be objectively reasonable and that this court does not need to decide whether Isabel actually experienced objectively a hostile environment. That's a question for a jury. And I think some facts that the jury could look at here are one, the fact that the university
But then
itself,
everybody gets to a jury. Everybody always gets to a jury.
Your Honor, I don't think that that's right because—
Well, why not?
Because there are multiple—
You just said it, the jury should consider.
There are multiple elements to a Title IX claim. Just to put this in a little bit of historical context, when the panel ruled for Isabel last summer, that was the first time this court had ruled for a Title IX sexual harassment plaintiff in 27 years. It was the first time it had ever done so under the Davis standard. So I think that we see that Davis enough without any of the additional rules that the university asks to layer on is enough. And here, I think a jury could find—
A trial judge can decide that on summary judgment, right? Whether or not there are sufficient facts from which a reasonable jury could decide whether or not the victim's fear was objectively reasonable.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that here there are two—
You're saying in some cases where there aren't any facts to support that, that wouldn't go to a jury, right? That would be dismissed on summary judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor. But here there are facts, including the fact that the university itself, administrators who understood the geography of the school, its size, how students use communal spaces, they found repeatedly during their initial investigation and hearing process that CFIS's presence created a hostile environment for
Move ahead to the reinstatement. You want to mix apples and oranges. You keep going back and say,
I take your point.
Move forward.
I take your point, Ms. Brosby, that those facts did not change.
That's correct,
Your Honor. It's relevant to the university's calculation or evaluation of this question at the time of readmission when Ms. Arana presents her concerns to the university. Can we flesh that out, please?
That's correct, Your Honor. So we
could you imagine if CFIS had
been— Hang on a second. Let's go to Anshin's point.
So I agree that the school's deliberate indifference starts with its reactions to the reinstatement, but what happened, there's a petition, but what happens before then speaks to what the university found happened, and in some instances, to what a jury could find happened. You know, if we're concerned that it's, you know, just Isabel's subjective experience of a hostile environment, the fact that the university had previously found that to be reasonable is one fact that a jury could look to say that's right. And I want to reserve the rest of my time. There's just one more quick thing I wanted to say on deliberate indifference, which is that the university says that in order to be deliberately indifferent regarding not providing more than the no contact order, accuracy is a violation of it. University says that it had to actually know he was going to violate the no contact order again. And in getting there, it's quoting from the wrong part of CS. CS talks about two ways in which knowledge comes into a Title IX claim. One is there actual knowledge of sexual harassment? For that, knowledge of risk is not enough. The school needs to have knowledge of harassment that has already occurred. Then knowledge also comes into the deliberate indifference analysis, and their risk is relevant because the question is, was the school's response reasonably calculated to address that risk? In its supplemental brief, in saying it needed to know that CFIS was actually going to violate the no contact order again, the university quotes from the actual knowledge analysis for its deliberate indifference argument.
Counsel, you were giving the limiting principle that Judge Lee asked for, and you articulated objective hostile environment as well as facts from the university's investigation. Was there, you were about to give one another factor. I don't know if you had completed your answer to the limiting principle question.
I think that there are, in terms of the hostile environment specifically, I think that the question is whether a jury could find that it was objectively reasonable that, that there was a hostile environment, and that a number of different fact-specific considerations will come into play there, including whether there's other evidence that people agreed with it, potentially concerning the use of shared facilities. A university is different than a city of the same size because students use this, the student union altogether in a way that doesn't really happen in a city. But then there are, you know, by the university's telling, seven other elements of a Davis claim, and all of those would have met for liability. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
We'll be giving you some rebuttal time. Judge Kurtz, did you have a follow-up question?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You got one?
Ms. Brodsky.
I'm sorry, Ms. Brodsky.
Judge Kurtz, question.
Yes.
I know that, several other circuits have concluded that a school subjects a student to harassment by making him, by leaving him vulnerable to it. In an environment, even if that further harassment never really occurs. Can you make sense out of that reasoning in light of the statutory language, in light of the subjected to language and timeline? Can you help with that?
Yes, Your Honor. So a student is subjected to discrimination if the school is deliberately indifferent to the sexual harassment, because that is itself intentional sex discrimination. Davis then kind of riffs on that language and saying that a student needs to be a school needs to subject its students to harassment by causing them to undergo that harassment or make them liable or vulnerable to it. That's actually an explication of the control requirement. It's a sentence that comes right after the announcement of the control requirement. I think the point being that whatever injury the student
Have to be subjected, in other words, to a further act of harassment.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'll just say a linguistic point from the university's briefing. It says that subject always means that what you're subjected to actually happens, and that's not right. So one familiar context might be from sanctioning, where we might say, for example, that Congress passed a new law that subjects polluters to a fine. That doesn't mean that all polluters have been fined. It might be true that no polluters have been fined yet. The idea is that the law makes the polluters vulnerable to a fine. And so that is the meaning of subjects that then lands in the dictionary as make liable or vulnerable to, and that Davis is then following.
All right, we'll reserve the remainder of your time. Thank you, Ms. Brodsky. Mr. Keenan, we'll recognize you now for argument on behalf of the appellee.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Brian Keenan on behalf of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System. The United States Supreme Court holds that to prove a Title IX claim about sexual harassment between students, a plaintiff must demonstrate that the school was deliberately indifferent to sexual harassment, which they have actual knowledge, that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it can be said to deprive the victims of access to the educational opportunities or benefits provided by the school. Ms. Arana's claim fails on several of those bases. That is intended to be a high bar, as this court has recognized, Davis was very careful about creating a standard that wasn't going to be met in every case. And that was because it was a spending clause claim that universities are accepting this obligation based on accepting federal funds. And therefore, to be liable, they have to take an action that's like an official decision to discriminate. And that's why it's such a high bar. I thought I'd start with deliberate indifference. So I think this case is pretty well governed by the Johnson versus Northeastern School District case on deliberate indifference. In that case, there was an alleged sexual assault actually amongst, I believe they were middle schoolers or junior high kids, so they're even younger than Ms. Arana. They brought a claim for Title IX, but this court said that you couldn't second guess the investigation that was done, which had limitations in that there certain witnesses weren't cooperating. They were trying to deal with law enforcement, but they had declined to prosecute. And
Mr. Keenan, it seems to me there's a difference between second guessing a decision and examining the school's decision making process. You know, saying what a school should have done, that's prohibited. But examining the decision-making process is allowing the court to evaluate the reasonableness of the decision, which seems to be our task when the standard is whether a jury could find that the university's decision here was clearly unreasonable. So is it your position that anytime a school does anything in response to being informed about sexual assault, the school can't face Title IX indifference, deliberate indifference liability? And why wouldn't such a rule allow schools to skirt Title IX, even when they've made a decision that they, knowing it won't protect the assaulted student from harm, or specifically here, even when there are facts in the record from which a reasonable jury could move?
It is not our position that a school does any one thing. It automatically lands on a Title IX case. I think that's clear. I do believe that the standard is high, though, and Mr. Rana's brief mentioned the prison medical indifference case where with a prison medical facility, medical professionals, when they're providing care to an inmate, it's not that they do anything and that they get off the hook. However, it has to be quite a high bar to meet, that it has to like fall below the bare minimum standards of a qualified professional. And then I think deliberate indifference is a high bar. So it is, so if a university takes things that are not clearly unreasonable, I think that's phrasing is important from Davis, that it wasn't distinguishing this from the attacks of the dissent, which was like, this is just a reasonable standard, and say, no, it's not. It actually has to be so high that it's not clear, not clearly unreasonable. And I would say that the motive.
Forgive me, yes. Here. When she asked for a safety plan after Mr. Cephas was reinstated, basically the university told her to call 911. They reinstated her after spending a lot of time with Mr. Cephas and his lawyer without even talking to the Title IX individual at the university or with her or her attorney. It's the ongoing consequences of any sexual assault like this that we should really be thinking about how pervasive and frightening it is to have your assailant on the very same campus.
Well, I think that's inconsistent with Johnson, where the alleged rapists were in the same school with the student. Even this court recognized that they would even see each other in the hallways, which would be very painful, I would think. However, the court said that that wasn't enough to show that to rise the level of deliberate indifference when the principal there had imposed a no contact order in the case. So
Are those facts somewhat distinguishable both than what we have in front of us? In particular, in the case that you just referenced, we had the principal engaging with the family of the victim. We also had continuous communication with the family of the victim. We had the family being aware throughout the process where the school was in the decision-making process.
I guess.
And as well, as you articulated, there was a no contact order in place.
Well, here what happened was Mr. Sievers was suspended. He filed a petition for reinstatement, which was publicly known. So that's why Mr. Lana was aware of it. And the university then made a decision to reinstate him with the no contact order continuing in place. It wasn't a new no contact order that had always been in place.
Not what I referenced. What I mean there, the facts being distinguishable, is that in the case that you referenced, we didn't have the individual in the school violating the no contact order to the degree that a lawyer and the victim had to kind of separate the two. And so here we have a no contact order that we know that at least there are allegations that Cephas had violated.
Yes, there's an allegation he had violated it once. I don't know that it actually is a violation of the no contact order because it wasn't actually contact between them. However, I guess you could call it an attempted violation of the no contact order, which what the university did was responded to him and said, you're not supposed to do that. And there was no further violation of that no contact order.
About 5 or 6 to 280 since Mr. Cephas had been on the campus where they had told him repeatedly that you have violated the rules of the university, don't do that. There was incidents in June when he first arrived on campus. There were 3 incidents. His first time being on campus, there was a violation of housing rules that he had walked through. So there have been several times they had told him, this is the rule, don't do that. So I don't think that we can just leave it at there was a no contact order and there wasn't a true non-violation. So that's, I don't want us to be flippant with the facts.
Well, I suppose those facts perhaps could be relevant if there was then a future violation of the no contact order. And I think many of these arguments kind of go together in the fact that deliberate indifference usually comes up when the school makes a decision, does something that doesn't actually result in stopping harassment and their future acts of harassment. Here, the school was made aware, took quite a bit of action, expelled Cephas, put the no contact order in place. There was a no contact order before the expulsion. And then there was new evidence that came forward. And I think just to explain the timing, which has been a big part of the plaintiff's argument, Cephas's criminal trial ended on August 2nd. So it's really not a surprise that he filed his petition for reinstatement after that acquittal, because he wasn't going to file it before that. He files it. The start of the school year is like September 4th. The first football game is August 30th, I believe. So they're at the same time. And frankly, Cephas has rights too in these situations in that the university can't just sit on its hands and let him not start the school year on time because fear of Title IX liability of the lawsuit. I will say to Judge Kirsch's question, we were sued by both parties here. So
I didn't even
So I don't think that timing is suspicious at all. And I don't think it's that.
The university is not disputing that he was acquitted of a different charge under a different standard than the one that he was found guilty of at the university level.
Yes.
There's agreement between the parties.
Yes, although I don't believe the DA actually brought that lesser charge to trial. So he wasn't acquitted, but he wasn't.
My point being that he was acquitted of the very charge that the university had already decided. From the university's perspective, there was not evidence to charge him. That's the knowledge of sexual assault or rape with knowledge of the victim's level of intoxication.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm trying to understand how the acquittal changed the university's assessment of the different charge, different standard that it had decided to submit to them. When you're talking about the university's evaluation in that 9-day period.
Well, there's a few things. So the two different charges are, one is like knowledge that someone is so intoxicated they can't consent. The lesser charge is just lack of consent. In this situation, I'm not sure how there's a difference, because Ms. Arana's testimony at the hearing, the administrative hearing, was that she was so drunk that she didn't know what happened and that didn't remember anything that happened that night. So to the extent there was a lack of consent, it would have been a lack of consent based on the person being so intoxicated that they couldn't consent. So I think that, I think a second factor is that Cephas, as would be expected, did not testify at the administrative hearing when there was pending criminal charges. He did testify at the criminal trial. Another thing is that there was evidence the university did not have in the first go round, which were video of Ms. Arana leaving the bar when they were going to the apartment.
His testimony, because he didn't get transcripts, is that
right? No, but the jury heard him, and the university did not have the opportunity to hear him the first time around.
A question, we're talking about a lot of other litigation that happened here. So Ms. Arana sued the university, Mr. Cephas sued the university, Mr. Cephas was prosecuted. Do you know, did Ms. Arana ever sue or Mr. Cephas in tort?
I don't believe so, but that might be a better question for my opposing counsel.
Counsel, let me ask you a question about a different fact. Say the university here said, you know what, we're getting sued by both of them, and we're done. We are in this very high-profile case going to say, we are not going to enforce our policy. If students attack each other, they attack each other. Go to jail. If you're not in jail, you're welcome on UW's team. Okay? Completely, deliberately different to what happened. Say after that, there's some bad actors out there. You get a flood of new students. And they're all people who came to your school because they were attracted to, you're not going to enforce the policy. And then Ms. Arana says, well, I don't want to go here to school. There's no post-notice harassment. Was she still subject to that harassment because of that decision by the university?
I don't believe so. I think you need actual acts of harassment. This is peer-on-peer harassment, so there needs to be an act of harassment under a Davis claim.
So you don't think that fact pattern would have subjected someone to harassment?
Yes.
Mr. Kinnear, what about the fact situation that I brought up earlier, where after the no contact order, after this meeting with school, Ms. Arana finds out that she's in the same chemistry lab class with Mr. In fact, not only that, but they were assigned to be lab. And so she's working with them, expected to work with them day to day. And so she goes back to university and asks the university, you know what, this is happening. Can you please reassign me or reassign him to another class? And the university says no. Okay. Let's say there's no evidence of an incident of harassment. Would the university's refusal to reassign either of them be actionable under Title IX?
I think that may be possible.
And why?
Say that again from here.
I think it's possible. I think what our problem is, like, we're not saying that a presence of someone who has harassed you in the past.
But my point is, in that fact scenario that I brought up, there is no actual second occurrence of harassment. There's a threat to harassment. She's vulnerable because she's lab partners with him, right? And under your articulation of the law, of the second incident element, you would say, under that assessment, the university could say no because nothing has happened yet. And the university would say, we'll only reassign you if he harasses you again. But until he does, we have no obligation. Isn't that the kind of eventual result of your rationale?
No, I don't think so. I mean, part of our argument is that we put in a no contact order, which is like completely contrary to just doing nothing and having the harasser next to this person in class. So we're not saying that the presence of a harasser necessarily couldn't constitute harassment. Here, it's based on a subjective fear that this might happen in a campus that has, I think, 60,000 students. That's quite large.
So
where there was no actual presence of him.
So if Ms. Arana's fear of harassment was objectively reasonable, would that be enough to trigger some sort of obligation of the university to act in the factual situation I gave you?
To act when there's the, like, they're sharing the same lab, right, the kind of thing? I think that could, because she's told them, this is a harassing situation for me. I'm not saying it wouldn't necessarily win, but I think schools do take action, and the university did take action here in putting a no contact order in. So now I think generally that thought there is that there will be subsequent harassment.
Yes, why there is a no contact order. Smaller schools and much smaller platforms may disagree with what you just said, because they might not have the luxury of moving students from one classroom to the next.
Well, that is
they,
true.
They have to say no contact order is it, and we're not deliberately indifferent, and we're not subjecting the student to further acts of harassment by putting them in the same classroom. I would be willing to bet here, this case is made somewhat easier by, I bet Cephas didn't even go to class when he was reinstated, okay? This is a little easier than a typical situation where I bet he wasn't even on campus, except for the football field, back and forth to his apartment and back and forth to the facility.
I mean, he did drop out after the semester ended.
Surprise, surprise. And that went to the NFL, right?
Yes.
And Mr. Keenan, can I clarify, please, your response to Judge Lee's question? Is your response that the university could potentially be liable because putting her in class and making her be a lab partner with Cephas alone is an act of harassment? Or that makes her vulnerable to harassment, to have to work with her former harasser?
No, I think it's you place this person in the situation to be so, well, working so closely together that could be an act of harassment. I do, to Judge Kirsch's point, I mean, in Johnson, they do talk about how the accused has rights as well, and there's issues with schedules and whether you can actually move someone to a different class. So that's not an automatic that you can be liable or you're required to do that. I took the question to be like, could that possibly be an act of harassment? I think a lab partner situation, I think that could be because you're placing this person directly in close contact with someone who she thinks she's accused of sexual assault.
And I'm wondering what because as an appellate court, our rule is trying to articulate a broad rules of and principles, right, that are applicable to different fact situations. What would be your rule that would distinguish that case from what you say we have here, which is, or a case where there's no further contact and the alleged perpetrator has left campus and all we have is subjective fear? So what distinguishes those two scenarios?
I think there's like a couple of things that are distinguishing that. One is that they've been put in close contact, but the victim has approached the university and said, This is harassing me. And so the university has knowledge of that specific, harassing situation. And if they fail to act there, that's like generally what Davis talks about, is like that you have notice of harassment. Now, maybe it isn't harassed, potentially that is, and they have special notice of this. And then I think you depend like, well, what, I mean, kind of on the deliberate indifference piece of it, like what are the options in terms of, like, what can they do to, like, remedy that situation? I think at the University of Wisconsin, it's not very difficult to, like, put people in different classes. And that happened here with the other player, Mr. Davis, who was in the same class, and they were able to, like, switch classes. A smaller school, perhaps, maybe there's different considerations there for small schools that don't have the ability to, like, just have thousands of students with many different classes going on.
Are we able to shift gears just for a moment? Sure. I know another factor that we have to consider for purposes of Davis is context, and context being under the school's control. And on the university's website for undergraduate housing, one of the options for students who want to go on campus is what we call the campus off-campus housing services on the university's website. And it directs students that if you want to live off campus, this is the marketplace to do it. And Humbucker Apartments is one of the ways that the university under its heading provides, as well as the rates if you stay at Humbucker Apartments. Is that enough to demonstrate control?
I don't believe so. That seems like a website that lists potential housing options for students, but the university doesn't actually control the premises. I don't see how that would be sufficient to have control over the context of that incident of harassment.
Mr. King, doesn't the university's disciplinary policy that applied to this event expressly reach off-campus incidents between students like this one?
Yes, that's true, because there's two factors of which the university has to have control of, which is control of the harasser and control of the context in which the harassment occurs. So we think that, you know, it shows control over the harasser. We don't believe it shows control over the context of the harassment. I think that was the mistake that the Brown case from the Ninth Circuit made.
Well, but both of them, they're both subject to the student code of conduct, which prohibits sexual assault. And the university had control over what took place on campus after the assault.
Yes, that's true. We don't.
Go ahead.
I could answer what I. We don't dispute that a university has control over what happens on campus and what happened, like once they acknowledge they could do certain things on campus. I think the point is that the first incident, like the control over the context, is supposed to be that the university could do something about harassment to stop it from occurring. We don't think that's the case with like off-campus housing, you know, where it's not actually owned by the university or not.
But that assumes the focus is on the initial assault, which does not seem to be the survivor's focus or her belief. Isn't our focus here, we've been discussing for an hour, whether the university adequately protected Ms. Arana from further harassment on campus after she disclosed her that hostile environment, what she feared, and talking about the completely unreasonable response. So it seems to me the context question, this discussion of the off-campus residents is not relevant.
Well, from our perspective, that there wasn't further harassment after that incident in the context of the university control, so all you're left with is this prior incident. That's harassment in a context the university did not control.
But isn't it the ongoing consequences of the sexual assault that we should be zeroing in on, and the university's response to her when she asked for help? I'm going to repeat, they told her 911, call 911.
Yes, well, I would say that, well, one, I think there is a case in the circuit saying there's no safety plan, that personalized formal safety plan that needs to be implemented. I think second, this happened in a meeting between the head of security on campus and Ms. Arana and her attorney, and I believe an assistant dean for campus life, which to me, the university personally meeting with Ms. Arana with these high level officials shows exactly the opposite of deliberate indifference, where you're just like, whatever, that harassment's going on, we don't care. I think Ms. Arana often cites the Fairfax County case where the officials there were like laughing and making jokes about an assault that had occurred on a school field trip. This is the exact opposite of that. I think they didn't think she had specific fears. It was a generalized fear that she might run into CFIS on campus. And I don't know that there's much that security can do about a generalized subjective fear that someone on a very large campus, you might run into this person accidentally.
Do you agree, counsel, that a context is limited to what happened on campus after the readmission? in regards to context?
Like the context of the harassment?
Yes.
We think that for the university to be liable, it has to be some place where the university has control over the context of the harassment, which in this case, it was really on campus. There are instances where perhaps off-campus behavior is, like this Fairfax case I mentioned, it was a school field trip, there's a school bus, there's students on it, you know, teachers and chaperones on the bus, that they have control over the context, even though it's not, like, technically not school grounds. But here, I don't know that there was any allegation of something that happened that wasn't on, that wouldn't have been on campus. I guess there just really wasn't actually an incident of Mr. Cephas doing anything further.
So irrespective of what occurred at the apartments, our focus should be simply on what occurred on campus.
In the context of this case, yes, I think so.
In the context of this case.
Yeah.
The council looks back to Lily DeVille.
No, I don't think that's true. The plaintiffs, and there's cross motions for summary judgment here. So there's like, it's like six briefs, which I find to be a little bit much, instead of like four briefs. So both parties move at the same time, then responses, replies. And the plaintiffs, their summary judgment motion on their behalf said that the university had control over the context of that.
Yeah.
So they developed facts related to it.
So let me ask you some facts. See if it's record. Who's a football player? Did the university control when he woke up?
Could they control when he woke up? I guess they could regulate. They could. The team could have a rule. I don't know if they can actually control when he wakes up.
I think they have a lot of control. I just don't know if that will make the control termination.
And
was
if that
the difference between control of the harasser and control of the context?
Yeah, I think that's like
they
the
don't
key.
They don't control the restaurants, they don't control the hotels, they don't control the gas stations in the town.
Yeah,
they kind of it's simple.
Mm-hmm.
Did the no contact order? I didn't see it in the record, but did it cover off campus or contact?
I believe it did.
Yeah. And so in some ways, this control, the university did have control, or thought it had control, perhaps. And so this control analysis sort of bleeds together, does it not?
Well, I think they have control over CETA, so they can try to impose discipline for things that happen off campus. I think there's two different, I guess, analyses. As one is what the university just decides to do for its discipline, and second, what's actually the law under Davis as to what can constitute actionable sexual harassment under Title IX. And so the university can try to go past that, you know, like trying to regulate behavior that it's not actually maybe wouldn't be liable for under Title IX, but still wants to let Cephas know that you shouldn't be contacting Serrana. So I think those are two different questions that I think it's often, you know, people take steps that go above and beyond the legal standard in terms of imposing discipline.
Let me ask you one final question. You talked about the gentleman at Spirit Farm. Suppose a student knows that the school's response to her attack won't be, so she takes matters into her own hands and, you know, changes her course schedule, spends is the least amount of time on campus as possible. How do we take, or how in your position, should we take the student's self-preservation actions into account in our Title IX deliberative defense action? Is the university's position that the only way Title IX liability attaches to a school is if the student allows herself to be attacked again versus taking matters into their own hands?
Well, we do think there needs to be some further act of harassment. It wouldn't necessarily have to be an attack. It would just have to be harassment. I think that I had something I was going to say, forgetting it. But could you repeat your question?
How do we take into account the student's self-preservation actions?
Okay, no.
Our Title IX.
But I do think that I haven't seen any, I assume I have red slides, that the student's subjective speculation that the school will not enforce any of its discipline would sustain a Title IX claim based on, you know, like just thinking that it's not going to, that the school is not going to do anything. This court, like in Johnson, has upheld, you know, when there's, you know, no contact orders.
Thank you, Mr. Keenan. Ms. Brodsky, we'll give you 10 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start you out with the case that is the large gorilla in the room. We haven't talked that much about that. Penhurst is the first case cited in Davis. And there, a school's deliberate indifference to post notice acts of harassment make it subject to Title IX liability. It's got to be clear whether the university had notice that it could be liable for its conduct. Otherwise, under Penhurst, we're supposed to limit that cause of action. Please give us the benefit of your thoughts, because Penhurst does, it's the foundation upon which all of this cause of action exists.
Absolutely. So after Penhurst, Bennett from the Supreme Court, Parker from this court, Jackson from the Supreme Court say that while a statute needs to give a regulated entity notice of what it's liable for, it doesn't require the level of granularity that would be required for, let's say, qualified.
It's got to be a clear state that it's called the Penhurst canon. It's got to indicate, well, this is the kind of claim because of a contractual relationship that exists between the recipient and the individual seeking a recompense. Given that, there's got to be some clarity. If it is unclear, circuit splits, we're not sure what the cause of action is, I'm not sure how there can be notice.
Sure. So 2 points there, Your Honor. The first is that I would point this court toward Jackson and Parker that specifically formulate how specific notice the statute needs to provide in the Title IX context, which is that both of those cases say that Title IX tells schools that they will be liable for intentional sex discrimination. So if what they are doing is intentional sex discrimination, they had specific notice. And that's why, for example, in Davis, where there was a circuit split before Davis about—
Let's not slide that between the pre-notice and post-notice, right? Because the university did not know about sexual assault. You know, it's only what they knew after. So your brief, I think, is pretty clear on page 22 that you're not talking about a pre-notice attack, but a post-notice.
That's right, Your Honor, but I think notice functions differently. So there's one question, which is the school's notice vis-a-vis its contract with the federal government, that did it have notice that it when it said, yes, we will take federal funds, that it could be subject to money damages for a certain set of actions. And the level of granularity you need there is it intentional sex discrimination or not? Not, could these particular facts be enough? I think there's then a separate question about whether the school has actual knowledge of harassment, and that's distinct from the spending clause statute. And the reason that Gebser adopted that had to do with the mechanics of the express administrative resolution with the Department of Education that requires opportunities for voluntary resolution. So I think those are separate kinds of notice.
But is this opening the door to any type of sexual assault claim then? It just strikes me there is no limiting principle. If the notice that's defined for Title IX for the type of claim allows a claim for any type of sexual harassment, then pre-notice, post-notice, the university would always be liable and then get sued both ways.
So tell me, Your Honor, if I'm not being responsive to your question, but I think that the question of whether the school had notice of what it was signing up for by taking money from the government is different than the question of whether it has actual knowledge of sexual harassment. And so it's absolutely true, this is clear from CS, that a school will not be liable, even if its response is clearly unreasonable, even if it should have known about harassment, if it does not have actual knowledge of harassment that has actually occurred. And so that actual knowledge requirement isn't going anywhere. While we have cases like Jackson, Parker, Hall from the Third Circuit, I'd point you toward Judge Menasche's concurrence in the recent Sule case from the Second Circuit that explained that in a case like this, the school has the knowledge it needs for spending clause purposes that it could be liable. If I can just make 3 points in response to the school's argument. So the first is I'm delighted what we agree on. So it sounds like the parties agree that the presence of a harasser can be itself harassing per LACA for the university's own findings. And also that presence can satisfy a further harassment requirement if one exists. Second thing, Judge Pryor, I just wanted to offer one more factor that might be relevant to the question of whether a victim's experience of a hostile environment is objectively reasonable, and that's the severity of the violence. So in this instance, Isabel had seen Sebas twice before in her life. The first time he repeatedly raped her, the second time he tried to make physical contact with her. So her fear was that if she saw him again, that she would do something bad to her again. And that then distinguishes a case where there might be lower level harassment, where a victim might still fear seeing their harasser, but a jury might think that that's not as objectively reasonable. I also just wanted to say something about forfeiture of the off-campus issue. So the university points to the fact that there was there were cross motions, but that's not a substitute either formally or practically for Isabel's opportunity to brief below the question of whether the school was entitled to summary judgment on that. So this court has already acknowledged that briefing on whether one party is entitled to summary judgment on an issue isn't the same as briefing on whether another party is entitled, because in one context, you're the plaintiff, you're trying to prove there is a dispute of fact. And the other, you're trying to prove there's no dispute of fact. And the way that that played out for Isabel here was that when she moved affirmatively for summary judgment, she focused on the post-assault on-campus hostile environment and the university's control over that context, which made sense because there's no dispute of fact over whether the university had control over that context. There was just a legal question about whether that's the right context to focus on. That's a great summary judgment strategy. I wasn't part of the team, so I can say that. When we're talking, though, about whether the university is entitled to summary judgment on this element, then it makes sense for Isabel to talk about control over the context of the rapes themselves, because there's a dispute of fact on that. No one's entitled to summary judgment on that basis. But because the university didn't properly raise this below, she didn't have the opportunity to develop the evidence, including information about the nature of this apartment, the nature of its relationship to the school that we know, but we didn't have an opportunity to put into the record. I'd also like to offer potentially a distinction for the court to keep in mind in terms of where reasoning, the school's reasoning fits in to its analysis. So I think Davis is very clear that a school is not going to be liable just because it gets the answer wrong. And so this court is not reviewing a school's findings or reasonings as though they were the findings of an ALJ on appeal to federal court. But that doesn't mean that the reasoning isn't a black box that this court can't touch, even if that reasoning or lack thereof is probative of part of the one of the party's claims. In this instance, the reasoning, the decision-making is probative of the later decision being pretextual and instead motivated by the university's own pecuniary and reputational interests. The school relies heavily on the fact that it was concerned about litigation from both sides, but Ricci versus Stefano tells us that being concerned about a lawsuit from one person or group of people is not an excuse to discriminate against the other.
Ms. Bratsky, on the topic of all those lawsuits, could you answer the question that I asked Mr. Keenan? Was there also litigation that Ms. Arana brought in tort against Mr. Seepus directly to recover for the assault?
No, Your Honor. Also in terms of the other lawsuits, you're right, Your Honor, that the charge that Seepus faced criminally was distinct not only in terms of the standard of evidence, but also in terms of the actual elements of the claim. And a juror actually went to the press afterwards and said that the element that they had been convinced by to acquit was the distinction between what the school found Seepus responsible for and what they thought they couldn't find him responsible for. That is, the juror said, we didn't think that there was enough evidence that he knew that the women were too incapacitated to defend. The school agreed with that in their initial hearing. In saying that he wasn't responsible for second degree sexual assault, only third. And I think that the Cypress Fairbanks case from the Fifth Circuit is very helpful on the point of how parallel criminal proceedings might come in. So there the court said that it might be reasonable for a school to rely on law enforcement investigative expertise, but it would be clearly unreasonable for the school to rely on a prosecutor's decision not to bring charges, because again, different elements, different standards of evidence doesn't mean that a violation of the student conduct can occur. And I think that that also is representative of that case, demonstrates the ways that a school's reasoning can come into play. So just like the Sixth Circuit in Waymer, the Fifth Circuit in Cypress Fairbanks said whether the school's decision to dismiss this complaint is clearly unreasonable or not depends on why they did it. And I think that that has to be true based on two uncontroversial principles from the case law. The first is that if a school receives a report of sexual harassment and does nothing with it, that's going to be deliberately indifferent. If a school receives a report of sexual harassment, investigates, tries to get it right, unfortunately just misjudges the evidence, that's not going to be evidence of deliberate indifference. In both fact patterns, you have no sanction. What that tells us is that how the school gets to its final result why it gets there, that is relevant to the deliberate indifference analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Brodsky. Thank you, Mr. Keenan. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.
Thank you.
All rise.